This is Kitchen Table Politics this morning, and in our studio is Steve Horn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Carol.
Really great to have you here. Steve and I know that we've really juggled this date for a long time. You probably even actually saw it in the schedule that comes out, and then Steve was ill, and but here we are. We're here this morning, appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule, Steve, which is one of the things we'll talk about first. Steve's getting ready. You are getting ready for your fourth trip to Bosnia?
Yes, I am.
When are you leaving?
I leave March 29th.
March 29th. And last heard, you were still looking for a translator and where you were going to stay and how are you doing on your tasks to get ready?
I haven't worked any of that out yet.
Well, another reason to be grateful you're taking this hour, really, out of your day to spend with us. So we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, when Steve came to Lopez. This is Steve's fourth trip to Bosnia, as I said. And your first trip was when, Steve?
1970 and 71.
Yeah, and how did that come about?
Well, I was a college student at the time.
And where were you going to school? I'm curious.
Amherst College.
Amherst.
In Massachusetts.
Yep, yep.
And so it was, there was a new program that Amherst had developed called Field Study, which you could apply for, and I did apply to take a year to travel, and I gave some details about what I was thinking about, but it was a little vague, too. I proposed a general plan and a region, and that I would be fairly self-sufficient. I would get a VW bus and live in it and keep my expenses down, and photograph in Europe and Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm. And had you been to Europe before?
I had been once on I think it was like 4 week long summer trip as after my freshman year in college.
Uh-huh. So you were going back to some of the same places?
Mostly different places. Different. That had been pretty limited. I actually got a summer job working in London that first trip.
I see.
And then traveled for just a week after that.
Oh, really?
That.
Yeah. So very different places.
Yeah.
So how did that work out? How long was it you were there the first time?
A year.
A year.
Yeah.
How did that work out for you, Steve?
Oh, it's an unforgettable experience and one of the richest experiences in my life, I would say.
What are some of the things that stand out when you, on this rainy morning here on Lopez, when you look back at it in your mind?
Well, now, can I just do a little disclaimer
absolutely.
When you invited me in today, we were going to talk about the old days of Lopez.
And well, so that's correct.
I just want to compliment you. You throw some great curveballs because when I walked in the door, Carol said, "Say, you know, I was thinking about Bosnia and your connection." And so I have no idea where we're going, I must say, today, but I'm going to try to follow you as best I can. But I wanted to just throw that in.
No, great. I appreciate it. I appreciate it a lot.
I'm not going to let you get away with just, you know.
Right, just doing it and pretending like this is what we planned all the time. And, you know, hopefully we might, who knows, we might end up getting to those stories today or we might do those another day. I'm really open to where this takes us.
Okay.
But since you are leaving soon, and I know some of the people here, I've certainly heard it, have seen your slideshow.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted a little bit of personal history, and we'll see how long and where that takes us. But thanks for that disclaimer.
Yeah. And I mean, one thing I thought about is maybe we could do a little bit about the old days while I still remember.
That's true. This trip abroad could be the last of your memory of Lopez.
But I'm glad to transition across, too.
Yeah.
And they're actually, as I was thinking about it while you were doing those public service announcements and community calendar, there is some connection and overlap, both in terms of the places and some of the things that are meaningful to me. So I think there may be a way to pull it all together.
Yeah, no, that doesn't surprise me.
We'll see.
Okay. So, yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. So, and I am curious about what brought you to Lopez and how close that was to your Bosnian trip.
Yeah.
So we're back in Bosnia, and you were about to talk about And I'm sure your answer could be different at different times you're uh-huh. asked, but today, yeah. what are some of the things that stand out as you look back at that college student?
Well, one thing that I realized was I was incredibly fortunate to be able to have my home with me mm-hmm. in the form of the bus that was also a dark room, because as I do trip planning now, I just think about how much that took away some of the variables of finding a place to stay every night and what would have been the expense of that and all the details.
Right.
It also maybe was a way that I didn't get as close to people in some ways as I do now
right.
staying with them. But I'm just aware logistically now, when I just plan out 5 weeks, it's like, oh my God, and the idea that somehow I did that for a year is, I am just realizing I took that a little bit for granted, that I had a roof over my head every night.
Right, right.
Low though it may have been. So I think, though, in terms of highlights what was especially meaningful about the first trip had to do with going to a place that was so different in its mix of people and architecture and in just every aspect. It was new to me. And there's something about when one goes to a new place, your eyes open wider and your senses are really alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, just quite struck by that, how it was so different from my experience coming into it.
Right.
So some of it was that, I guess you could say in a way, the newness of that. But
mm-hmm.
it was also that in the Balkans, there is a tradition of hospitality that is not like what we experience here. It's paralleled in some ways on a place like Lopez Island.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is some connection there. But in Bosnia and in the Balkans, it's extreme. I mean, here on Lopez, you don't... If a total stranger comes down the road and stops here and asks you for directions, you don't invite him into KLOI for a cup of coffee, right?
No, I mean, I don't, but I have invited him into my house.
You have invited him into your house.
Even
well, that's good.
Even recently, we got a call from the Bay with a stranger was looking for a room.
Oh, okay.
And it worked out okay.
Right.
It's not common. It's not even common.
Well, and your house is unusual.
Yeah,
that
no,
way.
I know. That's
you,
what I mean.
You have
I don't
kind
mean
of an Eastern European
yeah.
format.
Yeah.
Your hospitality.
Yeah.
But it was one that was very refreshing to mm-hmm. me. I liked that idea. That
yeah.
rather than being suspicious of a stranger, you welcome a stranger.
Uh-huh.
And so I felt that a lot. I experienced that a lot. People, without a language connection even,
mm-hmm.
they would just say, have a cup of coffee, have a shot of, plum
right.
brandy, whatever.
It occurs to me, I know you're of the Jewish tradition and culture and faith, and there is that in the ritual of the Jewish tradition with the place at the table. Is that not true?
For Elijah.
For Elijah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that it's actually acted on in this
right.
country by people who practice that faith, but
mm-hmm.
but it's in the ritual.
Yeah, it is. I'm not an authority to speak about
right.
know, all the meanings of that. I mean,
right.
that's for a prophet, but it's also the idea of, let all who are hungry come and eat is
right.
the principle of it.
Right.
I mean, we could spend a whole other radio show on how
right.
I don't think Israel is living up to,
right.
it's, what it really could honor in terms of its
right.
own principles.
That's true in the, and I don't want to get us too far
right.
apart, but it's true in the Christian tradition as well. They have the same tradition without that specific
uh-huh.
ritual about uh-huh. feeding the hungry and the poor as Jesus'
yeah.
Message. And so what's the primary religion in Bosnia? Let's get back there.
There are several.
Uh-huh. And what are
so
they?
There's Christianity in two forms. So there's the Catholic
mm-hmm.
tradition, and then Eastern Orthodox and Muslim is the third main one. And then there is a Jewish community in Sarajevo, especially, that was once a larger Jewish community, but still has a presence there.
Right.
And then there's, you know, smaller groups as well.
Right. Right. Well, we could go a lot of directions here, so I'm going to kind of reel myself in.
Okay.
And and what year was this you were there?
1970 and 71.
70 and
Fall
71.
Fall of 70, spring of 71.
And you were a senior in high in college then?
I was after my junior year.
After your junior year. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you went back to Amherst?
I did.
For another year?
Yes.
Yeah. And when did Lopez come on your radar as a possibility?
It didn't come on my radar as a possibility initially. It came on my radar as a place to check in on an old friend, Stanley Greenthal.
Uh-huh. And Stanley, of course, is now a DJ on KLOI.
Right.
And has had a home here, even though he's lived part-time in Seattle, but he's still on Lopez.
Yes, he is.
So he was an old friend and from...
elementary, junior high, and high school.
Wow.
So childhood friend and quite a close friend.
And where was that? You guys were in...
That was in Scarsdale, New York.
In Scarsdale,
so in Westchester County, suburban New York.
So your families knew each other, or you guys just knew each other
They
from
knew
school?
Each other, but our families were not close.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of those kind of friendships where...
You guys...
We were the friends.
And they just drove you here and there until you could drive yourself.
Yeah, they tolerated each other, I think. Yeah.
And Stanley had... moved here and
Stanley had moved here and married
a
woman Sue Lind, who had had a connection to Camp Norwester, and so they moved here in probably 71 maybe, and I'd heard he was out here, and in 72 I got in touch because I was kind of concerned. It sounded like it was this really remote island on the end of the earth, and I just thought he'd dropped off a planet or something.
You wanted to check up on him.
I wanted to check on him.
Make sure he was still doing okay in terms of his decisions.
Yeah, it sounded a little questionable.
Yeah. And we know Stanley is pretty.
So I called him up on the phone, actually, before I drove out and just confirmed, you know, that I was coming. And there was this guy at Stanley's place named Greg Blomberg.
Yeah.
Who, like, listened, you know, to the conversation going back and forth, and I was asking something about should I bring my bicycle, and Greg like seized the phone from Stanley and said, "Hi, look, I don't even know you, but look, just come here, okay? You don't have to worry about like what you bring and stuff like that." Which is just to say that Greg really hasn't changed at all over the years. He's still just, you know, kind of gets right in there and says what's on his mind, you know. So that was my first introduction to Greg.
That's a great one. That could happen tomorrow.
So I figured I'd come for... Uh-huh. I planned a trip across the country. I hadn't driven across the country before. I had a VW Squareback at that point. I outfitted it with a bed.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I'd take like a month, travel out west, go down to California, come back again to where I was living, which was at that point in western Massachusetts.
Uh-huh. And you were single and...
I was single, and I thought I'd spend maybe...
How old were you then?
I was 20, maybe 23.
24,
something like that, early 20s. And I thought I'd spend, you know, a week with Stanley, a few days. I didn't know what. I wanted some time to get down to California, too.
Right, right. So
that was my initial...
You got on the ferry. Was Stanley living on the land he's
Fisherman
on now?
Bay Road.
Fisherman Bay Road.
Renting a place on Fisherman
Bay. Oh, he was.
Yeah.
Is that place still there?
Nope.
It's gone.
It's been torn down and rebuilt as another house.
Yeah. So you got on the ferry, and then what?
Well, it was nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
And so I drove onto the island in the dark, which was strange, you know, to get my first experience at night. And I just remember the first thing that struck me was, why are there all these 90-degree bends in the road?
Yeah.
I wasn't familiar. You know, they were to honor the
40-acre
field.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, where I was from, it's like...
Just everything
no,
went straight.
No, it's the suburbs and that kind of thing. So that was strange, you know.
And
then there were these signs, like, for Bella Tierra Estates. And I thought, that sounds like that's some kind of classy place. Turned out there was nothing there, just the sign, and there never was anything built there. Bella Tierra Estates never
happened.
Became anything. But it's just funny when you know, like nighttime, what you can imagine. Yeah. I was kind of imagining all these fancy places on the water or something. You know?
And were you able just to drive up to his house? Or
yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so, and how long did you stay, and what was that like?
I stayed for, maybe 4 years? Let's see, 1972, 5 years. Yeah, never really left the island.
Not 5 days, but five years. Days, and no. You never really got back on the ferry for.
Oh, I did get.
You
back,
get back on the ferry.
I mean, I
but
I
you
just,
didn't.
I just mean I never went really.
You didn't go to California.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I never made it down.
And
there.
You were here for five years.
I didn't even have the car by the time I left.
Yeah.
Car I'd driven in.
Yeah. When did you buy your property? Fairly soon, or what? Where did you live?
No, that was all a process, too. I mean, at first, when I stayed on beyond a couple of weeks, people would say, oh, it looks like you're going to stay a while. And I said, no, I'm leaving soon, you know. And then after a couple months, people said, you know, if you stay much longer, you're going to end up looking at property. I said, no, there's no way. I have absolutely no interest in buying a piece of property. I don't want to be tied down to something, you know. So it kind of evolved like that.
Where did you live? Did you live with Stanley?
I lived at first with Stanley and his wife, Sue, uh-huh. who tragically died very young of a rare lung disease.
Hmm.
So
and you were there through that process with Stanley?
I was, yeah. Yeah.
A fortuitous
and
event.
And I think that influenced a fair amount my staying, mm-hmm. is, you know, mm-hmm. when I realized the reality of what was going on.
Yeah. Sure.
Which was harder for Stanley to share over the phone, I think, at a distance. Understand.
Right. Sure. And to have your support in real time, in the present tense.
Yeah.
And so what were those? You were there 5 years. So what were some of the? What happened? What were you doing during that time?
Well, my first job. Because that's
we'll put parentheses on that, huh?
Well. It's just, in some ways, the jobs that I had here were so different from my past experiences. My first job was caretaking Doberman Pinscher dogs for the school superintendent during a Northeaster. Because the person who was caretaking them had to leave the island suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed somebody in a hurry.
So you went over to this strange house with
It was up on the north
dogs.
End, and there were all these dogs and a kennel, and, you know.
And it was the first Northeaster?
And it was a Northeaster, and the water kept freezing, and I, you know, was dealing with that, and I ended up accidentally puncturing all of their water containers, but I didn't realize it till the thaw. Because I'd used, like, an ice pick, but I'd gone right through the bottom.
Sure.
So when it thawed, they just, you know. So that was unfortunate.
Who was the superintendent then?
His name was Jay Connors.
Oh, I never heard of him.
Yeah, it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
We're talking the early 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a nice man.
Yeah. So, and what else?
Doberman Pinschers aren't my favorite dogs.
Yeah, they weren't then and they still
are. And
aren't
I'm a dog lover.
Yeah.
I never got bitten, but they just seemed like, I don't know, they were, it's partly maybe what people had done with, you know, they'd had their tails docked and.
Yeah. Yeah, they
that kind of thing. They're not quite like a black lab.
Yeah. So, did you have dogs while you were here at some point?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
But you haven't had recently, or
I have had recently. We had Shadow, who died about a year ago.
Yeah, that's right. I remember Shadow.
May he rest in peace.
Yeah. And so, when did you and Hugh Lawrence run into each other? Was that kind of? I don't know.
We ran into each other probably, in 1974, maybe. Mm-hmm. So it was a little before the mid-70s, I think.
Uh-huh. So you were here significantly longer than he was.
Well, he had been up here. He was caretaking David Davis's place,
what's now the
Macaulay Farm.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure when he started doing that exactly, because we didn't know each other
That's interesting.
Before a certain point. Yeah, so I think maybe he came in, I don't know, maybe it was 73. I'm not sure.
So you met Greg Blomberg because he and Stanley were close friends.
I did meet him.
Who were some of the other people that you met early on when you were here that kept asking you, well, it looks like you're going to stay. Who were those people?
Well, two people. I think I'd like to remain nameless, but I want to tell a quick story about them.
Okay.
The first week that I was at Stanley's, a couple of people stopped by.
Mm-hmm.
And I got introduced to them, and then they went into the bathroom. And they were there for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you know, Stanley and I were talking, and I said, so, what's the story? You know, I mean, they've been in like, you know, half an hour or whatever. And what? So Stanley said, well, they don't have a shower.
I was going to say,
so they're using
guess.
Our shower. And it was like, why don't they have a shower? Well, because they don't have running water. You know, and it kind of like I was, it didn't dawn on me.
Right. Yeah.
About that.
Right.
And I just thought it was really unusual. And then probably within 3 months of that, I was like, not 3 months, let's say 6 months, I was on my land catching water into a cistern, which was basically a galvanized garbage can, and I'm taking showers at somebody else's house.
Yeah, so. Along with the rest of us, I think we can name it. We certainly were in that category. We moved here in 1977 and didn't have running water until 1981. Uh-huh. And Pamela and Stephen, I mean, there were a whole bunch of us that were in that category.
The only reason they're remaining nameless is because I haven't checked with them, and one of them has a very kind of prominent place in the community, let's say. So just, I think they'd be fine with it, out of respect.
No, exactly. I really do appreciate that.
Yeah.
So you became one of those people that hauled water to drink. And
yes.
Yeah.
And I was excited to have some land.
Yeah.
You know, that was
well, so you went all the way from, no, it's not, I'm not interested at all. I don't want to be tied down, to being excited about land. What informed that transition? And what are, I mean, I don't know if it's relevant right now, but what are some of the ties to your Bosnian journey?
Wow. Well, let me start with the easier part.
Okay. Okay.
The ties, I could do that, I guess. But part of it was I came to understand just from helping people out on their land about what a rich experience that was of just, you know, working outside and growing things and building things and having the independence of that and the satisfaction of you know, seeing what that brought about.
Uh-huh.
I also got tied in more to the community and the old timers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's not enough that I could say about how supportive the old-timers were about the young people who came here.
Who were some of those people that...
Oh, I think of, like, Lawrence Kaufelt.
Yeah.
And Bob Adcock.
Yep.
In his own way.
Yep, yeah, those are, yeah.
And the Krings. Mm-hmm. I had a neighbor, Granny Gaddis, Gilbert Gaddis's mother.
Yeah.
And Romaine Ritchie, and there were just a whole lot of them.
Well, I love hearing those names said, because I know all those people. Some of them were our neighbors, and were offered that same support to us years later. They were just really quite remarkable people, and very different from each other too.
They were, and they had such a wealth of knowledge that was just inside them and available.
Yeah.
And willing to share it. They had, it was nothing like about, oh, you kids, you're going to have to learn the hard way, and I'm not telling you what end of that shovel to, you know, point in which direction.
Right.
They had all sorts of folk wisdom, which was really wisdom that they had picked up, you know, that had been passed on, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And this sense of that. was strong.
Right. I remember a story Lawrence, and the stories they told, too, mm-hmm. of early
oh, yeah.
Lopez. I remember Lawrence talking about the first refrigerator uh-huh. on Lopez and how his wife at the time was, I don't remember the story too clearly, but how it all the guys, farmers on the island, were really mad at the first guy that got it because all their wives were bugging him to get refrigerators. So those kind
imagine.
Of stories.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, they had amazing stories.
They did.
Absolutely, and they were good storytellers.
Yeah.
Yeah. You had to, like, not be in a hurry.
Yeah.
You know, if you visited with one of them.
Right.
There wasn't like, hey, could I just stop by and borrow a screwdriver? It was like you had to plan, let's see, do I want to spend the morning borrowing a screwdriver and hearing? And usually it was worth it.
Yeah.
Because there was a different sense of time.
Yeah.
But I was remembering that one of the first connections I had to old-timers, but also to kind of like island ways, was I went to a yard sale that Earl Yost had
uh-oh.
At what used to be what is now Grayling, the former Grayling Gallery.
Yep.
And for a while that was Earl Yost had a lumber yard there.
Yep. Yep.
And maybe it became Sunset Builders for a little while, their first home. But he had this incredible sale. He was just selling everything. And a number of things he had, I had no idea what they were, but they looked fascinating.
Yeah.
And I would ask, you know, there were other old timers looking around. So there was like a peavey,
uh-huh.
you know, for moving logs
yep.
and a fro for splitting shakes
yeah.
and all these names of tools.
And tools that you hadn't seen
that
before.
I'm afraid those names are going to maybe fade out over
yeah.
time, or they're getting used less. And I just think how rich a lot of those names and tools were, and compared to names now of things like blogs and, you know,
yeah.
it's like, I don't know, it's just different.
Yeah,
you know?
It is different.
It's a different set of histories.
Yeah.
So,
wow, that's...
So I learned to use those tools
yep.
with the help of old-timers.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, Yost is a familiar name for us because he owned that whole section and we bought our
oh,
property
okay.
from him.
Uh-huh.
He owned it all the way over to Center Road there.
Yeah.
And, wow, all those old names coming alive with your memory. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
So, and your property now is what's now called Hooterville.
Mm-hmm.
And but then it didn't have a name. It was just a really rutty road in, right?
Right.
And did it go, the road go all the way back to Hughes at that time?
The road went all the way back to what was called then the Ritchie Homestead.
The Ritchie Homestead, so mm-hmm. past you. Yeah, and then
yeah.
he bought that his property next door to you from Richie, apparently. Then.
Yeah, and it wasn't exactly next door. There were a
yeah,
couple
in between.
But yeah,
yeah,
close by.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you two guys were neighbors, and by then Stanley had bought his property up on
Yeah, Stanley
the hill.
Bought his property even before I bought mine. He had
mm-hmm.
owned it quite a long time, I think. One piece of it he's added on
yeah,
to it. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So who were some of the bachelors you hung out with besides those two that I've brought up, Hugh and Stanley and you
uh-huh.
and or people I know, yeah, don't have to be bachelors.
Oh, okay.
They
don't have to be bachelors.
Who'd you hang out with?
They could be married people.
Yeah,
too?
They could be too.
Oh,
guys, I'm thinking about what guys do.
What did guys do? Yeah, well, actually, for one thing, Stanley was in relationship a number of times.
Yeah.
I mean, we each were, I guess, at different times. So it seemed like we were part-time bachelors,
mm-hmm.
Or we were at different times. Other people, well, Will Olander.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, he would have a music night every week at his place where
mm-hmm.
he would open up his house and play harpsichord music.
Mm-hmm.
And mix up a bunch of strong coffee.
And people would just listen and
yeah.
drink coffee
yeah.
and visit?
Well, and yeah, drink coffee. There was some beer. There were
yeah.
other things.
Wine,
you know?
Yeah.
yeah.
People were still making
but
wine then.
Wilbur had a reputation for making coffee that, you know, was pretty much solid. It had a little water in with it.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
yeah. yeah, I remember when, I think it was Wilbur carried the piano out to Iceberg Point for the wedding. Were you there?
Yeah, that was a harpsichord.
Yeah, there was a
uh-huh.
harpsichord.
Yeah,
yeah
that was his harpsichord.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was brought on the back of a pickup truck.
And, yeah.
Yeah,
that
for
was, for Nancy McCoy, yeah, and I forget her husband's name.
Right, I forget too.
So, but yeah, I mean, events like that. I mean, who would carry a harpsichord? That was a long way.
It was, and it probably you'd have to get a series of permits from the state,
yeah.
And I don't think you could do that anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, there were horses out there too.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. That's right.
It was a full scale ceremony.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. So, you had mentioned earlier, and you said, "Well, maybe I can make the connection." You had mentioned earlier that there perhaps were some deep. Or you didn't say this word deep, but some threads between the Bosnian, the first Bosnian trip, and I'm guessing some of it might perhaps be in the context of hospitality.
Yeah, it's also in terms of, I think, the old ways.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this, what I was describing in terms of ways things were done here.
Yeah.
And just the rich tradition of that and
right.
and the way that was passed along. And similar in... Bosnia still got a lot of agriculture happening. It's more than 50% probably.
Right.
Is agriculture is the basis of what people are doing. And a lot of that parallels the way agriculture was done here in the days before I even came here.
Right. It occurs to me that and I don't think I've ever thought of it quite in this context, because you had mentioned earlier the PVs and the froze, and that's just a metaphor for old tools and how you use them and what's worth doing, really, if you want to go to the roots of things that was passed on for generations, just generations.
Yeah. Well, there's another connection I'm thinking of, too, which is I heard an interview that Iris Gravel did about the Hands at Work book,
yeah,
talking about people using their hands and what a rich experience that was. And it got me thinking about how in the days when I used to use film, there were manual focus cameras. You adjusted apertures, you focused, you adjusted shutter speed. Then in the darkroom, you were using your hands with the developing and putting in the negatives. And I found, you know, gosh, I missed some of that.
Yeah.
And so I've decided on this current trip back, I'm taking only, well, not only, but primarily film, two film cameras and black and white film.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the same two cameras I took with me in 1970.
Wow.
I had one of them overhauled.
I love that. Because the other part of that I'm 68 years old, and I struggle with technology. And so there's a huge shift in who holds valuable information now.
Mm-hmm.
Because younger people, very young people, are much more skilled than I am. And it's much more, they're just intuitively more familiar with technology. And so the kinds of wisdom and experience I bring into the world doesn't have the same value anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it does, but it's not sought by as many people. I mean,
right.
I'm not diminishing the value of it. I think it's actually, over time, this is a cycle, and technology will take its place, but it won't be what it is now.
Yeah.
People will go back again to working with their hands and valuing their own
I think so.
Experience.
I mean, that's some of, you know, when you were asking me what drew me to having land.
Right.
In a sense, it was it was called the Back to the Land movement,
yeah.
And it was that idea of getting back to using, you know, either getting back to or maybe you'd never done it, you know.
Right.
I'd never done nearly as much shoveling before I got to Lopez as I did after I'd been here for a month and put in some fence posts.
Exactly. You know, I wonder if there's any person on the island that was going back to the land that didn't both shovel and use a chainsaw, because our generation was, you know, chainsaws
right.
were more common than the,
right.
than the other, in ways they would have never imagined in their whole life.
Well, I'm not sure I knew what a chainsaw was before I came to Lopez. Maybe I did. Maybe I'd heard the word. But, you know, I became familiar with them pretty quick, up to a certain point, to the point where I thought I could own one.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought one used from Josie Beecher.
Yep.
And it came with an instruction manual. And by God, some people don't read manuals. Well, I did. And they had an illustration of how to cut a tree down. And it said you make, you know, the front cut, you know, and then you start in from the back. And you leave a little bit of a wedge there. And you put the wedge-shaped cut in the direction you want the tree to fall. And it seemed like, wow, that makes sense. Only thing they didn't say, because they thought it was so obvious, was the tree has to either be straight up or leaning a little bit in the direction of that cut. And the first tree I tried it on was a pretty honking-sized tree, because it didn't occur to me maybe try it on something smaller. I was trying it on the main one that I'd gotten the saw for, you know, yeah. Which was this tree that was leaning over the toward the trailer. And I wanted to fall it the other way for safety.
Right. And how'd that go?
It didn't go too well, because I put the wedge shape cut in the direction that I wanted it to go, but it was leaning the other way. So it bound up the saw, of course, and scared the heck out of me. And I had to then deal with that. I had to, like, get a come-along and a block and tackle and a big ladder and climb the tree while it was starting to sway in the wind with a chainsaw.
Did you do all that by yourself?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, I did. And then the most ridiculous, I'm embarrassed to say this, and I'll only continue because I've started. I got the thing all come-alonged up, wedged up. Everything else, I couldn't get it to go over, but at least I got it so I'd taken the weight off the saw enough I could get the saw out and put a wedge in, but I couldn't get that tree to fall. And so that night I slept in the trailer with that tree all cut and come alonged and everything, and the wind came up, and I was listening, and I was just thinking, I know the wind's going to blow it the right way, but at first I heard the thing start to fall, and I thought, I sure hope it's going the right way. It did, but I mean, can you
there
imagine
you
how nuts that was to be I mean, have you ever heard a crazier thing to do?
You just stayed in the trailer and waited, let fate take its course.
I guess. I don't know.
So, well, you're here to tell about it.
So, anyway.
So you stayed in the trailer for a
chainsaw,
while.
My chainsaw story.
Well, yeah, one of many, I'm sure, as well as your post-hole digging story and your old truck
well
story.
Well-digging. Story.
Yeah.
I mean, I dug wells on the island.
Did you?
My first well job, I was hoping would start on the surface, because I didn't know if I'd be claustrophobic when I got down deep, and I thought, well, at least I'll get down gradually. Well, the first job was a well deepening job for a well that was already 30 plus feet deep.
Oh my God. So did you go down on a rope? Or
you go down with a winch and a bosun's chair and get lower down. Yeah.
And so what was up above that this was hanging off of?
A tripod.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, with a block.
Oh, okay.
That the cable came off of.
Right.
And you take turns going down and digging with a very short
shovel.
So
you were working with someone else?
Yeah, you always work with a partner.
Yeah, well, that was better than the trailer story.
Yeah.
And you got to have a bunch of old truck experiences, too. I mean, did you get your first old truck?
I got my first old truck when I was at Earl Yost's yard sale.
Oh, yeah.
And Wade Nash was there, who was Chuck Deitch's partner with Sunset Builders.
Yep.
And he had a truck he was selling for $100. And I bought that. It was a 55 Chevy, I think. And the bed was completely rusted out, so the first thing I did was I went up to Adcox to get a new bed.
Yep.
And he had one for me, a perfect one. We pulled off the old rusty one. We got the other one ready, and it turned out it was the wrong length. It was for a different wheelbase. But he said, well, let's just put it on there anyway with 2x4s, and we kind of monkeyed it on.
It worked out okay?
Not really.
Not really.
But it's a Bob. That's a Bob Adcox.
Yeah, exactly.
He pulled the old bed off by tying it to a tree, and having me drive. It's like, you know, pulling a tooth in the old way.
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot of my backpack stories, that's for sure. Yeah. So, and but the truck got you home and
truck ran.
Lasted a while?
The truck ran really well. It ran for a long time.
Oh, great.
The doors were the next problem. They would start to open when you went around curves.
Yeah.
That was Polly's introduction to the island. I still had the truck when she came. And I was going around the first curve, and I said, hold that door. And she didn't quite hold it enough, and it opened, and my toolbox flew out onto the road.
So you pulled over.
I said, you've got to really hold onto that door.
Yeah, you didn't quite get it. She perhaps thought that she should hold it for her own safety.
I guess.
Not to
not for the
door
toolbox.
Shut.
Yeah.
So. Oh, gosh. Well, it's wonderful to have you here, Steve. We've got just a few more minutes.
Yes.
And I love always, whether I'm in an audience like I was at your birthday celebration this year, you and Stanley, which was a remarkable event. And
yeah,
the stories
we turned
you tell there.
40 or something like that.
Maybe, yeah, right.
Maybe,
maybe
a little more.
It was a little more. Yeah, maybe
50,
maybe a decade,
60.
Something. So, and I love hearing your stories and your laugh and your willingness to expose us to both early Lopez and also being young and and innocent, really. There was an innocence that that you came here with about what it meant to be a Back to the Lander. And a part of it, I'm sure, as you alluded to in the beginning, started with the death of Stanley's wife, because experiencing in a really close and up personal way the process of dying is a profound experience many people don't have access to, as well as digging wells and fence posts and falling trees.
And it was also a way of Stanley and I really becoming friends as adults,
because
we had really known each other more
As children.
And high school students. So.
Yeah, quite remarkable.
So that was really the source of our connection.
And the other thing that I'm reminded of is how profound it is to stay connected to one place for this long, and how uncommon that is, and how the older people that you talked to when you came here had been here a long time.
Yeah.
Many of them, second, third generation.
Yeah.
And here you are. I mean, for us, say, you know, almost 40 years now, right?
Yes, it is almost 38, let's say.
Yeah, 38 years. Yeah. So, interestingly enough, that's a very long time in our culture to stay in one place.
Right. Yeah, and I think about that in terms also of that, what is it that keeps drawing me back to this other place, you know, to the Balkans. And I've definitely been thinking about that a lot as I, what do we have, like a minute now?
Go ahead.
A minute?
Yeah, go on, just go ahead.
I've been thinking that about that a lot as the trip comes closer, because it seems like every time that I go on one of these trips, I always have this point of asking myself, why the heck am I doing this? I mean, I'm going to this, why don't I go someplace where there isn't so much struggle happening within the country, and why don't I just stay where I am? Question, doubts, I guess, come up too. And so I need to each time kind of face those in a new way, you know, like to answer that well, and to trust that whatever is drawing me and leading me to go back, to have some faith in that.
Right.
Even if I don't have the answers.
You have no idea right
that
now.
That I just have that strong pull.
Yeah.
And I've, you know, and I've seen in my life that somehow out of that comes worthwhile and rich experiences.
Absolutely. Well, so I want to make a date when you return to talk again, and you'll know more then what that pull was today.
I will.
I hope. And what your experience was. And thanks so much for being here, Steve. I'm really grateful for your time and blessings on your journey, your fourth journey back to this, as you say, war-torn, ancient, really, culture and country, because it does have even a deeper history than we do. So, in terms of the human population, certainly.
Yeah.
So, blessings on your journey, and thanks again for your time, Steve.
Well, thank you. I enjoy this, and thanks for your good wishes.
Yeah. And this is Carol Steckler signing off for KLOI-LP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM, and good morning to you.